So you were raised in Romania, understand?
No.
Oh, okay.
So for the people to understand, I was born in a tiny village in Transylvania, Romania. What it means, Transylvania has a population about maybe 47 or 48% Romanians and 47 or 48% Hungarians. And the region has been grabbed by Hungary during World War One. Then after that, it became Romania, and it was grabbed by Hungary again during World War II. I was actually living in the same place where I was born, but in 1940, our village was occupied by the Hungarian army, and we came under the rule of the Hungarian government.
So tell me about life growing up. Your parents, Alexander and how do you pronounce your mother? Yeah, Jaffa. And
yes.
You have a twin sister, Miriam, and and then you had two older sisters, Edith and Alice.
Very good, yes.
Your father was a landowner and farmer?
Correct. And it was very peaceful, primitive village. The children basically played. In the winter we did go to school, but summer was no school, and we helped raise vegetables and raise flowers and help mom around the garden, because there was always work around the farm. We had chickens, ducks, geese, sheep, horses, cows, and lots of field, wheat field, corn field, just about all the produce that you want. And basically a very busy, busy farm. We also had a winery. We had lots of grapes, a great area for raising grapes.
Great place to grow up, it sounds like.
Well, we had an orchard that I think today's kids cannot relate to it, but we had every imaginable fruit tree, lots of apples, pear, cherry, peach, walnut, plums, and we, the children, could climb every single tree in the orchard.
And you were the Moses family?
Correct.
The only Jews in town?
It's not a town. We have got to really go away from the idea of town.
Okay, a small
place. It was an unpaved street.
Ah, okay.
Of about 100 families, no running water, no electricity. It probably was incorporated in some fashion or form, but that I was not aware of it. It's called Ports. In Romanian, it's spelled P-O-R-T with a little apostrophe under the T, which makes the pronunciation port. In Hungarian, it's spelled P-O-R-C, because the C in Hungarian is a sound of T. But see, in international, as I am using it today, I am going with P-O-R-T-Z to make sure that people understand it's a sound of T.
In a very small place.
Very, it's not on any map.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. If you sneeze as you drive on the highway, you miss the whole thing.
But unfortunately, as things go, the Nazis found the place. The Nazis
they
took over.
Yeah, they did. And I can see my parents reasoning that the Nazis won't come here, because the Hungarians were allies of the Nazis, but they were reluctant allies, and they were not really willing to give up the Jews in Transylvania, and they tried to drag it out and not conform with Hitler's wishes.
You were six when the Nazis took over?
Yes. I was six. In the morning, the Romanian army marched out. They begged our parents to go with them. But my parents said, no, we are not going to go anywhere. And in the afternoon, the Hungarian army marched in. There was never a shot, nothing. And the Hungarian army were very polite, which we did not expect them to be. And my parents spoke Hungarian, because most Jews in Transylvania, in order to get along with everybody, they spoke both languages. But at home, actually, we spoke Hungarian. That is my mother tongue. And so we could communicate with them, and my father became like an interpreter for the village head. And they stayed at our house because that was the only big enough house to accommodate some officers. Then within a week or so, the rules came in. My father had to go every 2 weeks to the nearby police station to present himself. If he didn't, he was going to be arrested. And that was very strict. And the threat, everything that they threatened us with was, if you don't do that, you're going to be arrested and taken away. By fall, the school started, and we had a one-room schoolhouse because there were maybe 40 to 50 kids, age 6 to 10. And they brought in new teachers controlled by the Hungarian Nazi Party. And they had a new book printed in Hungarian by the Nazi Party, and it said, if you have 5 Jews and you kill 3, how many are left? That is the way I went to school and learned arithmetic.
Amazing. It was in the math.
It was. And what I found out, that my former playmates in the village were my new tormentors. Kids are very mean to one another. You give them an opportunity to pick on somebody, and they are going to do an outstanding job. And so they would call us dirty Jews, spit on us, and beat us up. And when we went to the teacher would punish us. So really, we had nowhere to go with our problems. When we went home, we told my parents, and I expected, really, my mother more so than my father, to march to school and straighten it all out. And the truth is that children always expect their parents to protect them. My parents couldn't, and they said, there is nothing we can do about it. You have to learn that we are Jews, and that's the way it is. And when you go to school, we want you to be the best student in school. When you come home, you help around the farm, and at night you say your prayers, and God is going to help us, and everything will be okay.
What did your parents, what was the plan? Just sort of try to wait it out, everything will be okay after the war?
Let me tell you, my parents never shared any of their plans with us. We were the children. And I do not think that that was fair, and I resented it for many years. Also, we the children never had an opinion that the parents took in consideration. But I would say from my parents' attitude that they said, and let me tell you what I said to my father so you would understand. When I was 8 years old, and I realized that our situation was getting worse and worse with the new restrictions, I said to my parents, we should escape to Romania. The Romanian border was only 1 hour by foot from our house. And my parents said, you're just a little kid, more my father than my mother. You don't understand anything about life, big issues in life. We have a nice home here. We have plenty of food. You children go to school. And the Nazis won't come to pick up 6 Jews in this small village.
But, of course, they did.
My father, to my greatest sorrow, my father was 100% wrong, and I was 100% right. So early 19... So that is what I am getting their attitude from. They thought, this small village, they are not going to come and take us away. I understand it today a little bit better. I believe that nobody ever thinks that the worst thing will happen to them. It always will happen to somebody else. And that is true today. If you put out an alert in a city to evacuate the home because the flood is coming, where Katrina or other floods or other disasters, many people didn't leave. Oh, you lived here before, we are going to make it. And they didn't.
And I suppose just the idea of genocide was, you know, wouldn't have been thought of.
Well, I don't really think that we understood that there was anything that evil possible. We heard a lot of rumors that Jews were being taken to Germany and murdered, but we didn't know where and we didn't know how. And we really developed a little hope and slogan that we would never be taken to Germany. That was our hope. And the Nazis knew that because when they picked us up at our home in 1944, actually it's going to be end of this month, will be 69 years that we were taken to the ghetto. And the ghettos were throughout Europe. And our ghetto was mostly an open field surrounded by barbed wire fences. There was one building, the commandant headquarters, and we built our tent out of sheets and blankets. And it rained a lot. We were right there all April and May rained. But we kept saying that the families together, somehow we are going to make it. In the meantime, from the time we arrived, every head of the family was taken in for interrogation. My father was taken in toward the end of our stay in the ghetto, and he was brought back on a stretcher with bleeding whip marks. These were the Hungarian Nazis, and all his fingernails and toenails had been burned in an effort to find out where he hid all his gold and silver. And my father kept saying he was a farmer, and all his money went into land and equipment to work the land, but they didn't believe him. They said all Jews had a lot of gold and silver, so they kept beating him. Then 3 days after my father was brought back, we were loaded into cattle cars, and they were telling us, the commandant of the ghetto said, you leave all your personal belongings behind because the place you are going to will have everything that you need. So this way, they could get a hold of our possessions immediately and they could cram in a lot more people in the cattle car. We were crammed in about 100 people in a cattle car. It was hot. There were only 4 little windows at the top of the cattle car. The door was closed hermetically, and a bar came in from outside across the door, so you could not push the door open. Between each 2 cattle cars, there was a guard in a booth, and he had a machine gun, and he said, anyone trying to escape, I will shoot. Now, the train moved had top priority. It would only stop for one reason, to refuel. When the train would stop, we were very, very thirsty. It was very hot in that cattle car. We had no provisions, nothing to drink. So we would ask the guard by our cattle car for water, and he would always say, 5 gold watches. And the grown-ups would gather and pass those gold watches, and then he would throw in a bucket of water through the window. It was a strange exercise in futility. And I wondered, for all those days when we were there and many years after that, why did we do that? Because nobody got any real water to drink. I understand it in recent years. That was our only way of getting any information of where we were being taken. It was the end of the 3rd day when the train stopped. We asked for water, and the answer came back in German. I was 10 years old, and I instantly understood what happened. We have crossed the border into Germany. Our Hungarian guards have been changed to German. And that meant, for all of us, that the end was near. People in our cattle car were praying and crying, and the train moved on. We were in the cattle car for another 8 hours. The train stopped again, and we again asked for water, and this time there was no answer in any language, which I concluded this must be the final stop, and I was right. We heard a lot of Germans yelling orders outside, and then the cattle car doors swung open. A lot of people, thousands of people poured out. onto a little strip of land called the Selection Platform. My mother grabbed my twin sister and me by the hand. We were her youngest children, and she hoped that as long as she could hold on to us, that somehow she could protect us. Everything was moving very fast. And as I looked around on that confusion, on that selection platform, I was maybe there 10 minutes when I realized that my father and two older sisters disappeared in the crowd. I never ever saw them again. So holding on to my mother's arm, hand, as a Nazi was running and yelling in German, twins, twins, we did not volunteer any information. He noticed us because we were dressed alike and we looked very much alike. And he demanded to know from my mother if we were twins. And my mother asked, is that good? And the Nazi nodded yes. And my mother said yes. At that moment, another Nazi came, pulled my mother in one direction. We were pulled in the opposite direction. We were crying. She was crying. All I remember was my mother's arm stretched out in despair as she was pulled away. I never got to say goodbye to her, but I did not really realize that this would be the last time that we would see her. And all that took 30 minutes from the time we stepped down from the cattle car, and Miriam and I no longer had a family. We were all alone. And all this was done to us for one single reason, that we were born Jewish, and we didn't really understand why that was a crime.
There's no way you could understand, right?
No.
Now, the reason you were pulled out as twins, unfortunately, is because of Dr. Joseph Mengele, right? And genetic experiments.
Yeah, well, we didn't know anything. We became part of a group of 13 sets of little girls and one mother who, by miracle, was permitted to stay with her daughters. So there were 13 sets of little twin girls. Somewhere else on that selection platform, there were twin boys, but I was only involved and able to cope with my own little problem. We were marched to a huge building. Our clothes were removed. We sat naked for most of the day until late in the afternoon when our processing began. We, the twins, were given short haircuts. The mother's head was shaved. Our dresses were returned with a huge oil-painted red cross on the back, and the mother was given striped prison uniform. So to have our own clothes and our own hair was a privilege that we were granted. Then they lined us up for registration and tattooing. And when my turn came, I decided that I would give them as much trouble as I possibly could. Four people restrained me. Two Nazis and two women prisoners. While they heated a gadget, it looked like a writing pen with a needle at the end. And they heated the needle over the flame of a lamp. When it got hot, they dipped it into ink. And then they burned into my left arm, dot by dot, the capital letter A, dash, 7063. Miriam became capital A, dash, 7064. Auschwitz was the only Nazi camp that tattooed its inmates. My husband is a survivor of 4 years in Buchenwald. He does not have a tattoo. Once we were processed, we were marched throughout the camp. We arrived at a barrack, a modular horse barn, no windows. The windows were on the elevated part of the roof. Inside, everything looked filthy and crude. Three-story high bunk beds covered with a thin straw mattress and a dirty blanket. Miriam and I were given a bunk bed on the bottom, and we have not slept or stretched out in 5 days. So we thought maybe we could sleep a little bit, but human beings cannot function after such a traumatic day. As I was tossing and turning, I noticed something big and dark moving on the floor, and I began counting, 1, 2, 3. by the time I got to 5, I jumped up screaming, mice, mice, coming from a small village, a big farm. I have often encountered mice, and I was always scared of them. But a girl from the top bunk bed said, stupid kid, these are not mice, they are rats. And you better get used to them because they are everywhere. And now we couldn't even try to fall asleep. So Miriam and I went to the latrine. As I entered the place, there on the filthy latrine floor, there are the scattered corpses of 3 children. I have never ever seen anybody dead before. But to me, the message was clear that that could happen to Miriam and me unless I did something to prevent it. So I made a silent pledge that I will do anything and everything within my power to make sure that Miriam and I shall not end up on that filthy latrine floor. From the moment we left the latrine, I did everything instinctively and everything instinctively right. I never let any doubt or fear enter my mind. I never let go of that image of Miriam and me walking out of that camp alive until the day we were liberated.
Is that a lesson that you have kept with you for the years since liberation?
Well, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I realize, and I talk to young people today, they seem to have so many problems. So, and I also raised 2 children ourselves, that growing up is very hard. And it's hard everywhere, even in the United States. But what I tell kids, I did not give up on my life in Auschwitz. If you give up, nothing will happen. But if you have any difficulty, all you have to tell yourself, I am not going to give up on myself. I am going to keep trying until I figure out something that will work for me. And it always does. That is the way you accomplish anything in life, by not giving up, by hammering away at it, and you come up with a solution. That is a very important lesson for everybody, because later on when I talk about the lesson, I will tell you about that.
So tell me about these, this is just horrible to talk about, these experiments that Dr. Mengele was performing on you and the other twins.
Well, I was involved in 2 types of experiments, but that was not the whole scope. Because if twins were older than 16, or they were in a reproductive age, I realized from what I have been able to talk to other twins, because we do not have any data, the Nazi data of Mengele's experiments disappeared. Anyway, I was taken, Miriam and I were taken 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, to a lab that I call the observation lab. There they would remove our clothes. We would stand or sit for 8 hours a day. Every part of my body was measured compared to charts and compared to my twin sister. These experiments were not dangerous, but they were unbelievably demeaning. And even in Auschwitz, I couldn't cope with that. They were treating me like a nobody, like a nothing. So the only way that I could cope with it was by blocking it out of my mind. Therefore, all I remember about those experiments is that they lasted a very long time. In alternate days, on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, we would be taken to another lab that I call the blood lab. There they would tie both of my arms, take a lot of blood from my left arm. At the same time, they would give me a minimum of 5 injections into my right arm. And those were the deadly ones. To the best of my knowledge, they were germs, diseases, and drugs. After one of those injections, I became very ill, with a very high fever. It had to be August because my skin was burning from the sun, yet I was still trembling. both my legs and arms were swollen and very painful, and I had huge red patches throughout my body. The next visit to the blood lab, they did not tie my arms for injections and blood taking. Instead of that, they measured my fever, and I knew I was in trouble. I was taken to the hospital, which was another barrack, but in this case, it was filled with people who looked more dead than alive. Next morning, Dr. Mengele and four other doctors came in to study my case, but they didn't study it. They never examined me. They just looked at the fever chart, and then Mengele declared, laughing sarcastically, he said, "Too bad. She is so young. She has only 2 weeks to live." I knew that Dr. Mengele was right, but I refused to die. I made a second silent pledge that I will prove Dr. Mengele wrong. I will survive and be reunited with my sister. For the following 2 weeks, I have only one clear memory I remember often. Waking up on the barrack floor, I was crawling because I no longer could walk. And I was crawling to reach a faucet with water at the other end of the barrack. Because this barrack was not allocated any food, nor water, nor medicine. As I was crawling, I would fade in and out of consciousness, and I kept telling myself, "I must survive, I must survive." After 2 weeks, my fever broke, and then I immediately felt a lot stronger, and it took me another 3 weeks before my fever chart showed normal, and I was released and reunited with the other twins and my twin sister, Miriam. But Miriam looked very sick. She looked like the living dead. In Auschwitz, in my opinion, dying was the easiest thing. Living was a full-time job. And sometimes the difference between living and dying is people who gave up their struggle to live one more day, because that is all we could do. And they would sit, staring to space aimlessly. And that staring was scary to me, because I know she gave up on her own struggle to live one more day. Then I asked her, "What happened? What have they done to you?" She refused to talk. She said she couldn't talk about it, and we never talked about Auschwitz until 1985. In 1985, I again asked Miriam, "Do you remember that I was taken to the hospital?" She said, "Yes." I said, "What happened to you?" "Well, I was in the hospital." She said, "Well, for the first 2 weeks, she was under Nazi doctor surveillance 24 hours a day. They were waiting for something to happen. She didn't know what that was because they didn't tell her, and she didn't know if whatever they were waiting for happened or it did not happen. And I told her it didn't happen because it was the same 2 weeks that Mengele said I would die. Would I have died? Miriam would have been rushed to Mengele's lab, killed with an injection to the heart. And then Mengele would have done the comparative autopsies. I spoiled the experiment. I survived. And Miriam was not killed. According to the Auschwitz records, they had 1,500 twins used in Mengele's experiment. The estimated number of survivors is less than 200 individuals. Most of them died as a result of the experiment. Some might have died as a result of the conditions in the camp. Then I asked Miriam, "What happened to you after the 2 weeks were up?" She said she was taken back to the lab, injected with all kinds of things that made her very sick. After the war, Miriam was always weaker than I was. She got married in 1958. In 1960, expected her first baby, and she developed severe kidney infections that did not respond to any antibiotics. Second pregnancy in 1963 got worse. this time the infection got worse, and the doctors wanted to understand it, so they studied her, and they found out that Miriam's kidneys never grew larger than the kidneys of a 10-year-old child. I begged Miriam not to have any more pregnancies, not to have any more children. But she didn't listen to me. She had a third child, and after the third child was born, she developed immediately severe kidney problems. They tried to do the doctors whatever they could, but by 1987, her kidneys had failed. And she had to go on dialysis, or she had to go and have a kidney transplant. Miriam was a registered nurse, and she did not want to live with dialysis. I donated my left kidney. We were a perfect match. But a year later, Miriam developed cancerous polyps in her bladder. At that hospital near Tel Aviv, they have been doing kidney transplants for 10 years, so they had over 2,000 kidney recipients. All of them were given anti-rejection medication. Miriam was given also. None of them developed cancerous polyps, but Miriam did. They tried to deal with her cancerous polyps. They have given all kind of anti-cancer medicine, but nothing really worked. Miriam died June 6, 1993. The only other thing that I want to tell you that we were liberated by the Soviet Army on January 27, 1945. For me to realize that my little promise to myself that first night in the latrine became a reality was an unbelievable experience. So we were free. We were alive. We have triumphed over unbelievable evil.
That must have been an overwhelming feeling.
But see, also, even then, we did not know where to go. Because I was 11 years old. We were just 4 days before being 11 years old. Well, the world still looked to me very scary, and I didn't think I knew where exactly to go. So we located the lady who arrived with us, Mrs. Cengeri, who had the twins, because I saw her when the liberation picture was taken. She was there, so I knew she had to be somewhere in the area. And she ultimately came to the orphanage where we were taken after liberation, signed some papers, and she took us with her. So we were with her about 9 months, and then we got back to Romania, and she put us on a train to our village where there was nobody returned. There were only three crumpled pictures on a bedroom floor, and that was all that was left of my family. And then we were taken in by an aunt who lost all her family. And life in Romania after the war, people cannot imagine, but there was such poverty, so little food, that, and freedom was just a slogan because the communists took over. And many Jews were very scared because many Jews were wealthy, and with the proletariat taking over, they were arrested and taken away in the middle of the night. And the only reason that we were not accused of anything, because we were war orphans. I mean, nothing seemed to be working very well. And so in 1950, after trying to get our visa for 2 years, they wouldn't give it to us because we were young, and the communists wanted young people. And after 2 years, we got our visas. They took everything that we had, my father's land away, the home that we lived with my aunt, everything we had to sign over to them. And they permitted us to take nothing but the clothes on our back. So we arrived in Israel June 19th, 1950, wearing three dresses and a winter coat, because I stood in line with Miriam. We stood in line for 20 hours before they opened the store, and then a riot broke out. So we would have matching and winter clothes because we didn't have any winter clothes after we got back from the camp. So I was not going to leave that there. In Israel, Miriam and I were taken to an agricultural school where we learned to work the land and went to school for hours a day. And then when we turned 18, we were drafted into the Israeli army. Miriam studied and became a nurse. I became a draftsman in the engineering corps. And I stayed in the army for 8 years, reaching the rank of sergeant major. In 1960, I met on a blind date and married a tourist from United States from Terre Haute, Indiana, who came to Israel to meet with his brother. He, my husband, was liberated in Buchenwald by an American lieutenant colonel from Terre Haute, Indiana, and he never ever wanted to live anywhere but where his liberator lived. So that is the way I arrived from Tel Aviv to Terre Haute, which I think always is a pretty big jump.
That is a big jump. Michael Kaur was his name, right?
Right.
So you begin your life in America. I think you had some children.
Yeah, I mean, I was never... I don't know what normal is, because what most people call normal, I couldn't read English when I got here. Going to the grocery store was a whole challenge. When I got pregnant, for instance, my husband was going to be this magnanimous father and husband. He had never been to a grocery store before. He always ate in restaurants. So I made him a list to buy at the grocery store. And I was looking in Hebrew and English dictionary, but translating, and I ended up on my list with a strange item, scarlet cucumbers. And my husband came back an hour later and said, well, the store manager told me that they only have green ones. But see, when you don't know the language, I must have accidentally looked at another word. But I didn't know what the difference was. So I went with him to the grocery store, and I shouted him, I wanted pickles.
In
Hebrew, that is two words. And what it would have been correct if I would have found sour cucumbers. So life was a challenge all around. All around. There was nothing easy. So I don't know what easy is, because it's never been normal. What on earth is normal for most people? My children, for instance, would go to a birthday party, and then they had their birthdays, and they say, well, Mommy, where is our grandma and grandpa? We went to Joey's birthday party. He had his grandmothers and grandfathers there. How come we don't have any? So we were 3 years old. I tried to explain to them that there were bad people called the Nazis who killed their grandparents. Well, it was for a while everything they accepted, but they realized that I was different than the other mothers.
I wonder if you could tell me about the beginning of Candles. Apparently, 1978, miniseries The Holocaust, and you started wondering what happened to the other children?
Correct. I wondered, I mean, I had the pictures. And the reason that I wondered was I couldn't find any detail of our experiment. And Miriam was already very sick. And I wondered what has been done to us. So I thought maybe if I could find these children who were liberated with us, that we could have a gathering and we could piece together our memories, get a better understanding of what was done to us. But I had no names, no addresses, there was no internet, and I didn't know which direction to turn. I thought that my best hope was you in the media. Any media, any communication. So what I started doing, writing letters to, if I would read a newspaper, I would write down the reporter's name. If I listened to radio, I would write down the reporter's name. Same with the television. And then try to find their addresses and tell them who I was and what I was trying to find. Could they please publicize the idea that I was looking for these children? And if nobody really responded and not much happened. So wasn't until December of 1983 when suddenly I thought to myself, what if I formed an organization and made myself president? Maybe I could impress them. Because I was just Eva Kore survivor. There wasn't much attention paid to what I was doing. And this is the way that I put together the organization, incorporated it in Indiana in 1984, and I told my sister that she would be vice president. And with her help and my brother-in-law, my husband's brother that he came to visit in Israel, she put in an article. He was a journalist, and he put in an article in the front page center in Maariv, and that brought within 1 week 80 telephone calls with 80 names. And my sister said, now I have the names, you come and talk to these people because I don't know what you want. And then I flew to Israel and I told them that I would like to go back to Auschwitz. I think we need to know and show the world where we were and find out for ourselves, verify that that place really existed. And so that is the way the organization started. It is, we had names from 80 people, and by the time we went to Auschwitz in 1985, January of 85, NBC was decided to allocate a crew, but we had 122 names from 10 countries and 4 continents. So it was not an easy organization to try to manage. But we went to Auschwitz, and the world press followed us, and the stories became better known. But then they found these bones in Embu, Brazil, in June of 1985, and nobody was interested in the story of the twins. Yet we were left with the same problem that we had before. So,
and these bones were thought to be those of Dr. Mengele?
That was the official report, but in my opinion, they were not. And I don't want to get into that because I think that is very controversial. The United States government, I mortgaged my home on November of 1985 to have an inquest in Terre Haute. I invited the Justice Department, Office of Special Investigation, Neil Scher. I invited people from Germany. I invited Israeli experts. I invited survivors. I invited forensic pathologist. Dr. Michael Baden came to Terre Haute because we wanted to understand, and we wanted a pathologist to help us sift through the forensic report. And what we found out from our little simple and innocent project that Mengele's bones could not be these bones in Brazil because Mengele suffered from osteomyelitis, which is an infection of the bone, in 1926. And the way they diagnosed it, he had a hole in the bone. That's the way it was diagnosed. Where the bones found in Embu, Brazil, had no hole on the leg. There was supposed to be. So therefore, the Justice Department delayed the forensic report and the final report in the case of Mengele until 1992, October of 1992, when I knew that the report, the forensic report, not forensic, DNA report that was done by Dr. Alex Jeffries from Leicester University in England, that would come out. And then I contacted Eberhard Klein, who was the prosecutor for the Mengele case in Germany. He was very uncooperative. He kept changing the date of the press conference because I was going to be there. And I was going to ask a question that none of the reporters asked. Can they verify where the sample of the bones came from and the sample of the blood came from? There was no verification, no proof that any of the things came where they said they came from. And, of course, that question was never asked. Because all I told Dr. Alex Jeffries in a letter, I said, Dr. Jeffries, I'm sure you are a great DNA expert, but you cannot prove to us that the bones came from the bones of Embu and that the blood came from Irene, the first wife, and Ross Mangala, that child together. So if you cannot prove that, all you can say that the bone and the blood came from the same family. But that could be anybody.
I wonder if you could, this is remarkable. Of course, it got a lot of press. 1995, 50 years after liberation, you returned to Auschwitz, and you forgive.
Actually, we didn't get a lot of press.
Oh, you didn't? You didn't
amazing.
At the time.
We didn't.
I would have thought you would. This is remarkable.
No, actually, what we did there with Dr. Munch, we had at least 300 pages of press releases, handed them to people. And there were only three reporters. From one, a French reporter, one, an Israeli reporter, and one, a German reporter, who came to the press conference. The Israeli reporter wrote a nasty, scathing article about me that I am walking in Auschwitz hand in hand with a Nazi murderer. The German reporter was Bruno Scherer, who wrote a nasty article about Dr. Munch, putting in his home address, and Dr. Munch's house was firebombed. And then I talked to Bruno Scherer, and I said, how dare you do that? He said, well, I got even for my grandfather, who was an Auschwitz survivor. And the French was also a very alarmist report, and the French underground was going to, and they actually filed, the resistance movement in French fired lawsuits against Dr. Munch. So that is all I got in the press for that big, great event. Two adversaries meeting as friends.
Interesting. Yeah, you and in years since, of course, and you know, through the Candles organization, you go around talking. You do get interest, I'm sure, in this, because it is remarkable at that point you forgave the Nazis.
I forgave the Nazis, and I will tell you that idea of forgiveness, what people must understand, that it has nothing to do with Mengele. It has nothing to do with the Nazis, with Hitler. It has to do, it does not do anything to help them. If it helps them, so be it. But it helps the victim. The world is filled with victims that are never helped and never healed. This is a very simple idea, and the way I came up with it, not that I ever even thought about it for a moment. I stumbled on it when I met Dr. Munch at his home in Germany. It will be this August. It will be 20 years ago. And he treated me with tremendous respect, kindness, and consideration. I really went there in the hope that I could find out more information about our experiments, because he was a friend of Mengele's. That is what I was interested in. Well, he knew nothing about our experiment, but because he was polite, caring, and kind, I felt comfortable in his company. And out of the blues, I hear myself say, Dr. Munch, by any chance, do you know anything about the gas chambers in Auschwitz? Because, of course, there are the revisionists who say there was no Holocaust, there were no gas chambers. And this was my first and only opportunity to talk to a Nazi. And he immediately said, this is a nightmare that I live with every single day of my life. And went on describing the operation of the gas chamber, because he was stationed outside looking through a peephole as people were dying. I have never heard about it. He said, people, the Zyklon D, which is pellets, looks like pellets of white gravel, were dropped from canisters from the roof outside. They fell to the floor. operated like dry ice, and the gas was rising from the floor. People in the gas chamber or shower room, they were going to take a shower, but of course it was a gas chamber. They're trying to get away from the rising gas, climbing on top of each other, the strongest one ending up on the top of the pile. So when everybody was dead, there was a little mountain of intermingled bodies. The people on the top of the pile were the strongest one. So when Dr. Munch saw that they stopped moving, he knew that everybody was dead, and he signed one death certificate stating no names, just 1,000, 2,000, or 3,000 people. I never heard about that. To me, that was extremely important information. So I said to Dr. Munch that I was going to Auschwitz in 1995 to celebrate 50 years of the liberation of the camp, and would he please come with me and sign a document at the ruins of the gas chamber where it happened, and in the witnesses, in the company of at least 6 witnesses. And he immediately said yes. So I got back to Terre Haute, Indiana, very excited that I will have an original document signed not by a survivor, not by a liberator, but actually by a Nazi who witnessed it. And I was very determined to thank him in some fashion or form, but I had no idea how does one thank a Nazi doctor. And in my efforts, I tried, first of all, to go to a Hallmark shop and read thank you cards to get some ideas, but that was a waste of time. Then I went back to my own life lesson of never giving up. And for the next 10 months, when I was cooking, cleaning, or driving the car, I kept asking myself, how can I thank this Nazi doctor? And after 10 months, a simple idea popped into my head. How about a letter of forgiveness from me to Dr. Munch? I knew immediately that this was a meaningful gift for Dr. Munch, but what I discovered for myself was life-changing. I discovered that I, the little victim from Auschwitz, had the power to forgive. No one could give me that power, and no one could take it away. It was mine to use it in any way I could. Up to that time, I always reacted to what other people did to me. This was the first time I initiated something on my own, to write a letter of forgiveness. It took me another 4 months to write that letter because I worked through a lot of pain. And then it occurred to me that somebody even might read my letter, and my letter is available on our website under www.candlesholocaustmuseum.org. Click on Education Center. The next paragraph will come up, will be Letters to the World, and there are Dr. Munch's documentation of the gas chamber and my letter of forgiveness, which I call Declaration of Amnesty. And so I met with a former English professor in trying to correct my English spelling, because English is a difficult language, and I definitely have trouble with it. And then she said to me, now, Eva, that's very nice that you are forgiving this Dr. Munch, but you really need to think about forgiving Dr. Mengele. Just do me a favor. When you go home tonight, just visualize that you are talking to Mengele and you are telling him that you forgive him, and see how it will make you feel. And I did that, and I realized immediately, I said, wow, I even have the power to forgive the God of Auschwitz, because Mengele was God in Auschwitz. And once I decided that I could forgive Mengele, and I was not hurting anybody, I decided to forgive everybody who has ever hurt me.
That's incredibly powerful. I imagine you have gotten some reaction, range of reaction, admiration, of course, wonderment, but also criticism. How can you forgive something so awful?
Everybody says, how can you forgive? And when I tell them, I don't know if Mengele ever found out about it, knows about it, it does not matter. But what I find amazing is that forgiveness is an individual act of self-healing and liberation and empowerment. I have power over my life today and tomorrow. What they did to me almost 70 years ago no longer stops me from being the person I want to be. And if we want to ever change the world from victim to victimizer, victimizer to victim, I call forgiveness a seed for peace. People who are at peace with themselves do not want to hurt anybody. But people who are angry because they have been victimized always want to lash out at other people. So anger is a seed for war. Forgiveness is a seed for peace. And I would like anybody who hears this report, I need all the help that you can give me to sow those seeds of peace throughout the world.
What generally, we've talked about some of the lessons. You've talked about your journey to forgiveness, talk about never giving up. What are some of the other lessons you take?
Well, the other lessons that I talk about it is how do we deal with prejudice? Because one of the reasons that Hitler rose to power, actually, the main number one reason was, of course, the bad economy, the worldwide depression. And he said to his fellow, I mean, otherwise people wouldn't have voted for such a ding-a-ling like Adolf Hitler. And he said to his fellow countrymen, you don't have food, you don't have jobs, you don't have hope, and it's all the fault of the Jews. Because if something goes wrong, they have to blame it on somebody. And the Jews were always picked on for centuries, since at least 2,000 or 3,000 years. So we were the automatic scapegoats. And so as I look around in the world, I think that prejudice is still with us. So on my little bookmarker, when people buy any of the books from the museum, we include a bookmarker, and this is what it says. Lessons of the Holocaust by Eva Moses Kaur. 1, never ever give up. 2, prevent prejudice by judging people only on their actions and content of their character. 3, forgive your worst enemy. It will heal you inside and it will set you free. 4, give your parents an extra hug and an extra kiss for children who had no parents and who have no parents now. 5, each of us has an obligation and an important part to play in repairing the world. In Hebrew, there is a saying, Tikkun Olam, which means repair the world. And let Tikkun Olam, or repair the world, begin with me. And I believe that forgiveness is not only repairing the world of the victim, but it helps repair the rest of the world. And I also call forgiveness to other things. It's a gift I give myself, not the perpetrators. And if you want to have the best revenge against the perpetrators, forgive them, because what they did no longer has a hold over your life.
Finally, Mrs. Kaur, I wonder, you found 122 other Mengele twins. I wonder how they're doing. I guess a broad range of outcomes in their lives.
Oh,
how are they doing?
Yeah, they are not even willing to talk to me, most of them.
Why?
Because I forgave the Nazis, and they say that is somehow against them, and I have asked repeatedly, how does my forgiveness does anything against them? I went to Israel. We set up a fund at the museum, and I contributed quite a lot to that fund to try to interview all the twins who still are functioning, who have no mental problems, and could tell us what they remember. So I went to Israel December 2nd, 2011. And I set up 10 appointments. One of my board members, who is an Israeli, went ahead of time to actually call them and set up the appointment. And she called me from Israel. She said, nobody is willing to answer the phone. I don't know what that means. But somebody must have talked to them, and they refused to answer the phone. I told them who I was. So it was 3 days before departure. We went ahead because I couldn't cancel it. I had a person coming from New York who actually was on her way already to the place we were going. She first had to go to Atlanta to take her daughter to stay with her mother. And so there were too many. And the two reporters, NBC reporters here from Terre Haute, who had everything allocated for going. So I went ahead and actually I ambushed them at their homes. I didn't call because there was no use calling. And we succeeded in getting 3 interviews. Nobody would tell me why they didn't want to talk. Oh, they didn't remember too much or any of these things. One of the twins actually was very eager to talk. I did not get a hold of him when I was in the United States, so I found him later on. And he has also forgiven the Nazis, which to me was very rewarding to realize. And he said the reason that all the other Mengele twins are angry because they are envying you and they are envying me. They don't know what to do. They do not know how to rise above the... I said, I'm trying to tell them. Don't tell anybody they have to do it. But actually, if you understand, if anybody would try, and it's not a religious thing, they are trying to tell me that this is a Christian religion. I am Jewish, I am not Christian, and I can forgive, and the sky has not fallen in. So, actually, Jews have a very important holiday. It's called Yom Kippur. So that's not that foreign to Jewish religion, yet nobody is practicing it. And so what I found out among that 90% of the Israeli twins are on tranquilizers and antidepressants. And that is, and I have, instead of that, I have forgiven. Because they cannot cope with the memories.
That would be very, very hard, I think, for a lot of people to cope with memories like that.
Well, I think it's not as difficult. Because we could teach. And this is, even you, with your radio program, which is heard many places, if you could advocate that forgiveness is not for the perpetrator, but to help the victim. And what kinder thing could we do for every victim but to help them heal themselves? Because you cannot do it for another person. Each person has to do it for himself or herself. But I would like that to dismiss the idea that it's hard. Because that just, in some way, feeds the flames of anger and that it cannot be done. It can be done. It has been done. And it's being done by other people. I am not the only survivor of a tragic event in the world who has discovered that I have power over my tragedy. And that's exactly what I'm trying to say to every survivor. You have power over your tragic past. And you are the only one who can heal yourself. And the solution is free. It costs zero money, so it wouldn't be difficult for anybody to avail themselves of forgiveness.
Well, that's a good place to end it. We very much appreciate your time. Very important message. Thank you.
Thank you very much.